We'll begin with verse 1. So it came to pass in those days that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered. The census first took place while Quirinius was governing Syria, so all went to be registered, every one to his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he is of the house and lineage of David, to be registered with Mary, his betrothed wife, who was with child. So it was that while they were there, the days were completed for her to be delivered. She brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. That's that time of year, you know. It's Christmas. And as you can typically anticipate coming to church, you're going to hear a Christmas message. It is just the way that it works. You've been blessed over the last several years because Pastor Sandy is an expert at Christmas stories. As a matter of fact, he can look at this passage from about 100 different ways, apply it 100 different ways, and you're like, wow, that was a really good Christmas message. But I'm not Pastor Sandy. Now, as I've been studying the Word, even recently, the Lord's been challenging me to kind of break from the norm to a degree. Often when we approach a passage, specifically a passage like this, we approach verses, chapters, even books from what I would call a micro perspective. What is this story saying? How does this story apply? And that is good exegesis. That's a good way to study the Bible. But personally speaking, I've been trying to kind of get my mind into a perspective of examining Scripture from kind of a macro perspective, which means that instead of just getting in on like the microscopic details of each verse and the word and the story, etc., I've been trying, just in a personal sense, to examine, okay, how does this story, how does this verse, how does this book apply to the big picture? You know, we've got gobs of verses in the Bible. You got gobs of chapters. You've got tons of smaller books, but you have one book. And sometimes we forget that. We forget that this is like one story given by God to communicate a big message. That message, as we all know, is redemption. Genesis 3, man took his boot, stuck it in the proverbial manure, and made a mess of things. The whole story is God fixing that problem, God providing a remedy. Now, when I approach this passage, there are two questions that arise in my mind that the passage doesn't exactly answer. First, this is God's kid. You know what I'm saying? I mean, this is the Son of God. So why in the world is it so important to God to have his son born in Bethlehem? Like, really, I mean, you get the impression from this passage that God went to, like, really big lengths to move Joseph and Mary out of Nazareth, send them 80 miles uphill to Bethlehem. For what reason? God used Caesar Augustus, put him on an ego trip, so he wanted to number the kingdom, know how many people he was ruling over, just so people had to go back to their hometowns. I mean, it would have been a lot easier, a little bit more simplistic, probably even safer, for Mary and Joseph to have remained in Nazareth. I mean, she's in turn, man. I mean, she's big. And Joseph has to tell his wife, his betrothed wife, that they've got to make this 80-mile donkey ride? That's bad. Now, the passage doesn't really answer that, does it? It seems to indicate that this is important to be born in Bethlehem, but it doesn't exactly clue us in on why, the reason. The second big question I have is, really, why did God need to come as a man? I mean, have you ever contemplated that? I'm sure you all have at some point or another. But really, ultimately, I mean, he's God, right? I mean, he spoke everything into existence. Created earth, set the sun, put us in a spin and around it, hung the stars, made fish. Like, I mean, God is pretty powerful. So, I mean, why is it that God had to come as a man? Like, why did Jesus have to, you know, pop out of Mary, get wrapped in swaddling clothes, and right in the manger? Like, why was that necessary? Once again, kind of a question, big picture question, that you don't actually get information about from this passage. But my hypothesis is there's another passage that answers these questions, and not only answers these questions, but makes these seven verses come alive in a way you've never seen. Now flip to Ruth. There is a literary technique. You find this technique in cinema. You find it short stories, long stories, full novels, old school, new wave, romantics, horrors, you name it. You'll find this particular literary technique applied. If you tell a story, this is one of those things that you use to add flavor, depth to your story. It's called foreshadowing. Now, let me give you a formal definition for foreshadowing. Foreshadowing is the presentation in a work of literature of hints and clues that tip the reader off as to what is to come later in the work. Great example of foreshadowing is the story of Bambi. You remember that story? Right? Bambi. And you know, Bambi's this, you know, getting his legs, you know, underneath him. And you know, Bambi's mom, they go out into the field. Shots are fired, they run into the woods, and they have this conversation, right? Because Bambi's like, well, why did we have to run? Why did we have to flee? And Bambi's mom, I cried, by the way. But it's sad, man. Even in my research, I went back and was watching YouTube videos, and you're like, don't die, don't die. She dies. They should change that. Stinks. But you know, Bambi's mom is talking to Bambi. And Bambi's like, well, why did we have to flee? Why did we have to run? And Bambi's mom makes this statement. She says, well, there's all kinds of dangers in the forest, but none more dangerous than when man comes into the forest. Now, that is classic foreshadowing, because as we know, what happens? Bambi's mom gets shot by a man. On a side note, that man was Chris Yancey. Chris Yancey just, boom, took care of Bambi's mom. Classic foreshadowing, right? Now, in the realm of foreshadowing, there is another specific technique. It's a form of foreshadowing that I think really, really applies to what we're going to look at. It's called formal patterning. Now, you'll never need any of this information. Just go with me. But formal patterning, let me give you a definition, is the organization of events, actions, and gestures which constitute a narrative and give shape to a story. Formal patterning allows the audience the pleasure of discerning and anticipating the structure of the plot as it reveals itself. Now, a classic example, and this is the Christmas season, so I'll use It's a Wonderful Life, of formal patterning. You remember the old black and white 40s film? You had George Bailey. You know, and the story kind of opens where George Bailey, they have this company, right, that Mr. Potter's wanting to purchase out, but they're holding strong, you know, the mom and the pop. Well, George's uncle, remember, takes the $8,000 to make a deposit, and he loses it. Now, evil Mr. Potter, he finds it, and he hides it. And there's this scene where George Bailey comes running into Mr. Potter's office, right? Now, Mr. Potter makes this statement as George enters. He says, a miserable little clerk crawling in here on hands and knees and begging for help. Now, the next line, formal patterning. No securities, no stocks, no bonds, nothing but a miserable little $500 equity and a life insurance policy. Ha ha ha, he chuckles. And then he says, you're worth more dead than alive. Now that very sentence, you're worth more dead than alive, does what? It sets the course of the entire movie. Because George is thinking about the possibilities, right? I could go to jail. I could be arrested. It could bring shame to my family. It could be ruin to the town because Mr. Potter. And he reaches the conclusion, right? I might be better off dead than alive. And so he goes to commit suicide. And that's when the angel Clarence comes and you know, shows him what life would be like. But that statement, you're worth more dead than alive, is formal patterning because it sets the tone for how the character develops throughout the rest. Now, I think in Ruth, you find formal patterning. Formal patterning, by the way, really makes the Christmas story come alive and answers the two fundamental questions we had at the beginning. Now, the story of Ruth opens, now it came to pass. Isn't that kind of funny, right? Let's be honest. Sounds like Luke chapter 2, verse 1, and it came to pass. Well, it came to pass. In the days when the judges ruled the land, this was a horrible time period in Jewish history. The era of the judges, you can go back a book to your left and read more about the period, this time period of the judges. But Israel had slipped into just political chaos, moral depravity, I mean, wicked godlessness is kind of the atmosphere during the judges. And it was during this time that a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, he, his wife, and his two sons. Now, this man was a man by the name of Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their two sons had the names Mahlon and Chilion. Now, they dwelt in Bethlehem. Bethlehem is better known as the house of bread. That's literally what the word Bethlehem means. And we're told a famine comes into the land. Now, there are 13 references of famine. In all instances in Scripture, famine is used by God as judgment or punishment. They're divine instruments that God uses to correct the behavior of his people. So they're in the town of Bethlehem, the house of bread, and famine strikes. Not really good for the house of bread. The earth is scorched. There's no rain. The harvest is weak. Not a good place to be during a famine, the house of bread. So Elimelech takes his wife, their two kids, and they leave the promised land. They flee. As a matter of fact, they go all the way to the land of Moab. They cross back over the Jordan. They go into the section of wilderness that the Jews had spent like 40 years dying in, just to escape this punishment of God. And while they were there in Moab, the two sons take wives. We read verse 3. So Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. And they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah. I don't know. I always want to say Oprah. Right? Did you kind of get that feeling when you read that word? Orpah. The name of the other, Ruth, they dwelt about 10 years. And then, more tragedy, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the women survived, two sons and her husband. So here you find that they fled the house of bread, this family. They go to Moab. Elimelech dies. The sons marry. The sons die. You have now three widows, Naomi, Orpah, and Ruth. Now, during this time period in history, it was not good to be a widow. The widows were actually the lowest, most disadvantaged class in society. Women were uneducated and really, for the most part, had to depend on their husband for survival and sustenance. Their job was to have babies and kind of take care of the home. Now, the problem is that it was worse. It was bad enough being a widow. It was worse to be a widow without any sons. Because if you had a son and your husband dies, then that son, man, he's elevated to head of the household. He's now providing and taking care of you. So you have three widows. None of them have kids. And so Naomi decides, she's like, man, the Lord has dealt with me. We should have never left Bethlehem. This has been miserable being in Moab. I'm going back to Bethlehem. And these two daughter-in-laws are like, sweet, we'll go with you. But Naomi's like, no, seriously. Go back to your father's house. I mean, Orpah, Ruth, you're young. You still got your future ahead of you. You can find a good guy. You can remarry. You can move on with your life. Well, Orpah was like, That's true. Ruth's like, I know. But really, Naomi, we want to go with you. Now, to be a widow from Moab in the land of Judah added an entirely new dynamic. Because don't forget, during the period of the judges, one of the nations that God had used for conflict was the Moabites. The Moabites were hated by the Jews. They were despised. So here's Ruth and Orpah. And Naomi's like, no, really, you don't want to come back with me. The likelihood of you ever remarrying is slim to none because you're a Moabite. Secondly, because you've been married before, no one's going to want you. Thirdly, it's going to be tough and it's going to be dangerous. You could be taken advantage of, persecuted, ridiculed. Now, that's all Orpah needed. I'm going home. You sold me, Naomi. And Orpah walks off the pages of Scripture. We never see her again. There's an old Jewish kind of folklore concept that Orpah actually was the mother of Goliath. There's nothing to necessarily back that up, but just food for thought that Orpah kind of ended up being the mother of a section of giants, Goliath being one of them. Ruth, on the other hand, Ruth makes a decision in the later half of chapter 1 that though it would be more difficult, and though there would be trials, and though the likelihood of remarrying was slim, and though her life could be on the line, she was determined. We're told that she grabbed hold of Naomi. And in verse 16, we read Ruth saying, "Entreat me not to leave you, Naomi, or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge." Wow, you want to talk about a connection, a family tie. I mean, Ruth's like, Naomi, wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, you will lodge. I am going to be with you. I am going to follow you. This is friendship. This is family. There is a connection and a bond, a deep bond. Now, they were both widows. They had both suffered. Naomi first, I'm sure that she had a huge encouraging effect on Ruth when she was going through the same thing. But beyond just the family connection, Ruth's decision took on a whole nother dimension. She continues, "Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." You see, you would call this a genuine conversion on Ruth's part. Ruth is determined to go to Bethlehem, to go to the promised land, not just because she loves Naomi, but because she loves God. Now, how she was exposed was only speculation. She was a Moabite. She had grown up in Moabite culture. She had grown up in the Moabite religious system, which had child sacrifices and temple prostitution. I mean, was as gross gets. And for some reason, she's like, you know what? I have seen something in you. And your love for your God, he's real. And he's powerful. And I want what you have. And Ruth's like, not only am I going to go where you go and lodge where you lodge, but your people will be my people. And your God will be my God. And then you know what? We know this is a genuine conversion because she makes a decision and then acts upon it. Because what does she do? She goes. And she has a wonderful reputation of godliness and virtue. Now they return to Bethlehem. And as the story unfolds, it was time to go out and to try to glean in the fields. Now, this concept of gleaning, the law was smart. If you were poor, a widow, poverty, an orphan, you needed welfare. Leviticus 19 established what was called gleaning. And what this meant is that if you owned a field and you were harvesting that field, you could only make one pass. You see, whatever was left over, whatever was laying on the ground, whatever the fragments, the remnants of the grain, the wheat, the barley, whatever it was, the poor of the town could come out and collect for themselves enough sustenance, enough food. It was a great welfare program because not only did it provide for the poor, but it created a structure by which the poor had to actually do something and have some action in providing for themselves. So it worked in a great way. Now, Naomi, Ruth, they're widows, they're poor, they're down and out, they're outcasts, they're the lowest of society. They're disadvantaged, big time. And chapter 2 opens that there was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. Now, that's almost like foreshadowing in the foreshadowing. We'll get to it in a second. So Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I might find favor." And Naomi said, "Go, my daughter." So she left and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And it happened that she came to the part of a field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now, this concept of "it just so happened," I love the old King James Version. "It just so hap." Whoever says hap. But it gives the idea that this was by chance, that this just kind of took place. But we know that from our vantage point, what might be chance, from God's vantage point, is called sovereignty. Because this story, God is behind the scenes, working things in such a way that we have a beautiful love story develop. It wasn't an accident that Ruth stumbled upon the field of Boaz. And why was that not an accident? Well, verse 1 tells us that Boaz was a close relative of basically Ruth's. Now, this word "relative" in the Hebrew is the word goel. And it doesn't necessarily just tell you that this is like a distant cousin or a far-off relative. This gives the idea that this person, Boaz, was a family member with authority or prominence, an elder. Like, he was that guy that was organizing the Christmas dinner. He was the guy that everyone was looking at, kind of keeping the family together. Boaz was that man. He was the goel. Now, another translation for goel is kinsman redeemer. And that is hugely important for the story. Boaz was a kinsman redeemer to Ruth. Now, let me qualify that by going back into the Old Testament, into the law, and explaining what the kinsman redeemer really was. Leviticus 25 and Deuteronomy 25 talked about the role and the function of a kinsman redeemer. There was what was called the Year of Jubilee. The Year of Jubilee had an awesome, awesome application. The Jews were really big, God was really big, on family keeping their land and keeping it intact. Don't forget that when they entered the promised land, after Joshua and his conquest, they divided the land between the tribes, and then the tribes divided the land between the family groups so that you had like the Getlik parcel of land, right? And that was yours forever. Now, if you had to sell it at some point, right? Or it got taken, repoed from you. At the Year of Jubilee, or the 50th year, what happened is it was like the economic reset button. Everything went back to its owner. So though you sold your land, at the 50th year, the Year of Jubilee, your land was restored, right? Now, in the meantime, there was what was called the kinsman redeemer. Because let's say you sell your land year 2. You have 48 years before the land is returned back to the family. Beyond that, another function of the kinsman redeemer is like, let's say you owe, Capital One 20 grand. And you're like, "I can't pay that." This is back in the day. I know that applies to none of you. And you're like, "I can't pay this bill. Like, what am I going to do?" Well, in that culture, you'd be like, "Well, I really don't like the middle child. So I'll just sell the middle child to pay off the debt." Like, "Yeah, son, I know you were planning on school, slavery. Daddy's got to get out of debt." You could, like, sell a child into slavery. You yourself, your whole family, if you couldn't pay your debts, could be forced into slavery. So whether it was land or whether it was, slavery or whatnot, the kinsman redeemer could come in at any time. He didn't have to wait to the Year of Jubilee. He could come in at any moment. And he could say, "This is not happening in my family. And because I'm a kin, how much do they owe?" And he could write a check. You see, he could satisfy your requirements, the debt that you owed, and thus redeem you. He was a kin that redeemed. You sold the land. That stinks. We want to keep it in the family. How much? He could redeem the land. So the kinsman redeemer could redeem persons could redeem property. But he had a third function. The third function was posterity, or successive generations. Now, this is how the kinsman redeemer applies to our story. Because Ruth was a widow, which means that she didn't have a son, and the danger was that Elimelech's family line could be lost forever. She needed a son. She needed to provide her deceased husband an heir. And by law, she could go to the Goel. She could go to the kinsman redeemer, and she could say, "You need to marry me and provide an heir for the family." Like, she has that right. So the kinsman redeemer could redeem property, persons, and posterity. Now, Ruth is a widow. Ruth doesn't have a child. She just so happens to end up upon the field of her goel, Boaz. Now, though this story could have gotten very legalistic, it doesn't. As a matter of fact, it develops and it buds into a really nice romance. Because we read in verse 5, as Boaz comes to the field, Ruth's out there gleaning, Boaz said to his servant, the servant that was in charge of the reapers, "Whose woman is this?" Now, once again, our English translation of the Hebrew just doesn't do its service. Basically, what Boaz, like what's being painted, is that Boaz walks into the field, and it's like that Roger Rabbit moment where his eyes jump out of the front of his head, boing, and he's like, "Who in the world is she? Who is she with? Where have I been? Where did she come from?" All that's jammed into the Hebrew, I promise. But Boaz is like, "Oh my goodness gracious, this woman, she's a babe. She's hot. She's a 10, and she's in the fields. She's a working woman. I dig it." Now, as things develop, because, you know, Boaz comes over and he's working, you know, his mojo. And he's like, you know, "Hey, what are you doing?" She's like, "Oh, I'm reaping in the fields, you know, according to the law, blah, 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 blah." And Boaz is like, "Oh, well, that's good. You should just stay in my fields, you know, and like my women, you can hang out with my women." And not only that, but like, really, like I'm going to give you an entourage of bodyguards just to keep you safe. I just care. I'm just that kind of guy. I just care. And if you're thirsty, I mean, they'll draw you water. You know, Ruth, Boaz. And not only that, you really know that Boaz is head over, because he goes to the reapers and he's like, "Listen, Ruth, whew, this is what I want you to do. You know, she's working hard. But like, if you just so happen to knock some off, like right behind you, you know, so she can pick it up, go for it." Boaz not only kind of works his game, but he gets some wingmen involved. If you're a single guy, you need a good wingman. It works for Boaz. So here it is. Now we get the idea, though, that Ruth's starting to notice Boaz. Now, if you read through this chapter, you might say, "Well, how do you know that, Zach?" Focus in on verse 14, because Boaz, this is all on the same day. He kind of just like, "Hey, Ruth, it's mealtime. I come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." Basically, layman's terms, "Hey, you want to go grab lunch? You, me, some lunch. We'll keep it with a group. That's fine." Right? So what happens? They're on this lunch date. She sat beside the reapers. He passed parched grain to her. She ate, was satisfied, and kept some back. Fellas, if you're a single guy and you go on a date, you go to a nice restaurant, and she eats every bit of the meal, she's not into you, she's into the meal. Trust me. Just trust me. But if you go out on a date and you sit down, and she's like, "Oh, I just really don't have an appetite. I'm just watching my figure. Oh, this is way too much food for me." And she takes more home with her than she eats there. Then you're like, "Yeah, she came from me." You see, this is what happens with Boaz. "Hey, you want some lunch?" They go to lunch. And she just keeps some back. "Oh, that was just way too much for me." which kind of tells you that what's going on with Ruth. Oh, man, Boaz. What a cutie. Right? Now, we're told in verse 23, so Ruth stayed close by the young women of Boaz. I'm sure she did. To glean until the end of the barley harvest and wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Now, the indication here is that kind of a few months pass. This whole dating situation, flirting in the fields, you know, having lunch, dropping hay, you know, it's all going on, right? For months. Now, please understand, Boaz knows that he's the Goel, just like Ruth knows that he's the Goel. But Ruth really keeps it back. Like, she had every right from the first moment that she came across Boaz to say, yo, Bo, doesn't matter. Now, Boaz could have rejected her, but that would have been a horrible insult in that culture because Ruth would have been able to take Boaz, you know, to the gate with all the elders, and I'm not making this up, smack him with a sandal and spit in his face. Like, and that was just not cool at all in that culture. And so, now sometimes that beat the alternative because let's say you've got a wife at home and you're the Goel and she's like, hey, taking me home. And you're like, I'll take the sandal and the spitting because there's no way I can sell this to my wife. Like, honey, this is just what the Bible was telling me to do. There's three of them. Sorry. Like, you know, I mean, sometimes that worked out to your favor. Like, I'll take the insult. It's better than her, right? But not so with Boaz, and not so with Ruth. Ruth keeps a very laid back kind of interaction here. And Boaz is waiting. I mean, this is the stereotypical waiting game. When is she going to ask me? When is she going to ask me? And you can see him going to the other girls in the field. Have you heard? Check yes or no. Do I have a note? You know, I mean, that's all. It's like middle schoolers in ancient Bethlehem. Now, ultimately, chapter 3 opens because this was a temp job. It worked well because they were around each other every day, but Ruth's now, I mean, the harvest is over and she's going to be at home and, you know, Boaz and her crossing paths not going to happen often. So what ends up developing is that Naomi's like, listen, girl, I need grandbabies. It's time to get this on the road. It's threshing floor time. There's a big party going on. This is what you need to do. The widow's garb. I know you like black and all, but really a little purple. Like, throw on kind of a nice dress, honey. You know, show some leg. And then she's like, you know, you need some perfume. You know, kind of get yourself together. And also, oh, this is very key. Bathe. Like, you should really bathe, Ruth, you know. So, like, she takes a bath, she gets dolled up, and she goes to the threshing floor. But Naomi gives her a further instruction. Like, there's going to come a point, like, he's eating. Don't interrupt the man while he's eating. Like, that's what it says. Women, this is a big point. Men love conversation before dinner. We can tolerate it after dinner. But, like, during dinner? Really? This is food time. This is just what Naomi's giving advice to Ruth. I'm just passing it along. You got a problem with Naomi, not me. So let him eat. He's going to go to sleep to protect the, you know, the wheat that he's been threshing. And then this is what you need to do. You need to go up and you need to uncover his feet and lay at his feet. Now, there are some of us that are like, huh? Like, what in the world kind of a culture is that? Now, there's nothing sexual in any implication here. As a matter of fact, the uncovering of the feet, this whole practice, was very common. What it did is it was the biggest display. Uncovering someone's feet and laying there at the base of their feet was the most powerful way that you could communicate to that person total submission. It's pretty powerful. So here's Ruth, and she goes to Boaz. Now, chapter 3, verse 8, it was about midnight. That must have been a good meal. And the man was startled. I would be. And he turned himself, and there was a woman lying at his feet. Whoa! He says, "Who are you?" So she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are my goel," or close relative. You see, Ruth comes to Boaz and says, "Boaz, I want you to redeem me. I want you to satisfy those requirements. I want to be your bride." Now, this is what Boaz has been waiting for. I mean, he's been waiting and he's been waiting and he's been waiting. Let me translate the rest of the chapter for you. Yes, yes, awesome. That's what I've been waiting for. Sweet, it's there. Like, that's the rest of the chapter. Like, so much so that he sends her home and says, "Baby, I'll pick you up tomorrow. I'm on it." Like, this is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. And as it develops, you know, Boaz ultimately redeems Ruth. They're wed. They procreate, have babies and a family. It's wonderful. Now, okay, Zach, what does this have in regards to its application to Christmas? Like, where are you going? I've been following with you. I've kind of laughed out of, just to be nice, I've laughed a little bit to make you feel good. But where are you going? Because you need to be done soon. Please understand, the law of the kinsman redeemer, this is the only story we have in Scripture to illustrate what redemption means. And then its implication: why did Jesus need to become a man? Well, you were lost. You were a slave to sin. And that was a debt that you couldn't pay at all. And the world had ripped you off, and you were barren and alone. And Jesus said, "You know what? I'll redeem you. But understand, in order for God, according to the law, to redeem you, he had to be a kin." You see, that's why it was so crucially important for Jesus to come as a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes and to be laid in a manger. Because Jesus is the only person in human history that can satisfy, in regards to the big issue, your sin, that can satisfy both the half of kinsman and the half of redeemer. He can be your kinsman because he came as a man. He is your brother in regards to humanity. He was born and he lived. He died and he rose, but he was a man just like you. But he can be a redeemer because of his sinless deity. You see, this is why the Word had to become flesh and dwelt among us. It's why Jesus had to come and live as a man and then die to pay the penalty. You see, as you read through this story, Boaz redeeming Ruth, he paid a penalty, he bore it, and he was glad to do it. Like, Boaz was not motivated to redeem Ruth out of obligation or family law. No, for Boaz, it was 100% because of his love, man. He loved Ruth and wanted nothing more than to redeem her and make her his bride. Now, Boaz's mother, it's interesting, not mentioned here in Ruth, but if you look later on in Matthew chapter 1, this list of names, 90% of the time, you skip that page and go to the next one, and that list of names, you find that Boaz was begot by Rahab. Boaz's mom was Rahab, the Jericho harlot. You see, Boaz, hey, he knew what that meant to make the statement, "I want your people to be my people, and I want your God to be my God." He grew up in that family, and it was love in his heart and grace in his heart that he didn't care she was a Moabite. He didn't care what she had done in Moabite culture before Naomi had ever come on the scene. He didn't care that she had been married before. He didn't care nothing, but he just loved her. And the application is very powerful. Jesus wants to redeem you from your sin. Jesus wants to restore you from the land that Satan has ripped off. Satan wants to restore the years that the locust has eaten. He wants to redeem. But you know what? Like our story here, he can only redeem once Ruth comes to his feet and says, "I'm your maidservant. Take me under your wing. Please be my redeemer." You see, Jesus is your kinsman redeemer. He is your Goel. And he can redeem you from all of those things that are going on. But the only thing he's waiting for before that work starts is for you to come to his feet and say, "I'm your servant. Be my Goel." Why Bethlehem? Well, isn't it interesting? The fields of Bethlehem in the first century, you see the birth of Christ. Several hundred pages earlier in your Bible, it's an easier way of doing time, you find in the fields of Bethlehem a beautiful love story that illustrated what? Exactly what Jesus had come to do. It's pretty cool. And why Bethlehem? Why Bethlehem? Well, if you look at the last verse of the book of Ruth, you discover that the child of Ruth and Boaz, Obed, begot Jesse, and Jesse begot King David. You see, the great-grandparents of King David were Ruth and Boaz, but in the bigger sense, the great-great-great-great-great-great, there's a lot of them, grandparents of Jesus, was Ruth and Boaz. This story sets a course. If Naomi and Ruth had never come back to Bethlehem, if Ruth hadn't come back to Bethlehem, if this love story hadn't have happened in the fields of Bethlehem, if they both hadn't have been virtuous, if they both hadn't have loved each other, if Boaz hadn't have redeemed Ruth, David would have never been born, and thus it would have been the house of David later, right? So it wouldn't have been a big deal about Bethlehem. And yet, we find there's a lot of foreshadowing in Ruth as to what would take place in Bethlehem. And so, I leave you with this. I think it makes more sense why the wise men and why the shepherds and why Mary and why Joseph there with a little babe wrapped in swaddling clothes in a manger, why they took the moment to bow at his feet. It was that he wasn't just a baby. He was their kinsman redeemer. That God had come wrapped in swaddling clothes with one purpose, redemption. Redemption because of love. And I just encourage you during the Christmas season, when you look at the babe in the swaddling clothes in the manger, whether it's a nativity on the mantle or an ornament hanging on the tree or a live nativity that you drive by or the postcard you get from the relative you don't like talking to, whatever it is, when you see that babe in that manger, may it be a reminder to what that really means. It's by that moment that you have a kin that could redeem. Pretty cool. Father, Lord, we thank you for your word.